Omaha Public Radio presents a special program on Noon Forum. We'll hear the third in a series of three debates presenting candidates in the upcoming general election on November 4th. Today's debate will be between the two candidates for governor of Nebraska, Republican Pete Ricketts and Democrat Chuck Hassabrook. According to a recent CBS News, New York Times poll, as reported by Omaha Public Radio, Pete Ricketts holds an approximate 20% lead over Chuck Hassabrook. This program, presented by the Nebraska Broadcasters Association and NET Television, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, October 2, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the candidates and do not necessarily represent those of the Nebraska Broadcasters Association, NET Television, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the candidates and the panel is our moderator for this program, Dennis Kellogg, NET News Director.
Welcome to the 2014 Nebraska Gubernatorial Debate, presented by NET News in cooperation with the Nebraska Broadcasters Association. I'm NET News Director Dennis Kellogg, and I'll serve as the moderator tonight. We are live from the Ron Hull Studio at NET in Lincoln, Nebraska. Tonight's debate will feature the candidates for governor, Republican Pete Ricketts and Democrat Chuck Hassabrook. We welcome those joining us on NET television and radio or the NET website. Also, many Nebraska Broadcasters Association member stations are carrying this debate. And a welcome to those joining us across the nation on C-SPAN 2. We're live tweeting this debate. Use the hashtag NETDebate on Twitter to follow us. And you can give us your comments during and after the debate on our Facebook page at NET News Nebraska. Well, for the next hour, the candidates will face questions from Nebraska journalists and each other. The rules are pretty simple. Each candidate will have 90 seconds to respond to the question, and if warranted, there may be a 30-second rebuttal. Tonight's debate is taking place before a live studio audience. We've asked the audience to refrain from applauding or cheering, as it'll only take time away from the candidates. Well, before we meet the candidates, let's introduce the panel of journalists who will be asking the questions tonight. Fred Knapp of NET News, Susan Reisinger of WJAG Radio in Norfolk, and Adrian Whitsett of KETV in Omaha. So let's get started. A coin toss earlier determined the order of our opening and closing statements, and we begin tonight with Chuck Hassabrook.
Well, thank you for joining us, and thanks to NET and the Nebraska Broadcasters for sponsoring this debate. I would also like to say a special word of thanks to the love of my life and my wife, Kate, and our sons, Anton and Peter, for joining us, as well as my running mate, Jane Raybould. I'm running to get Nebraskans working together to build a better future in our state for our children and grandchildren, to strengthen our middle class, strengthen our communities, and create good jobs and genuine opportunity for every Nebraskan in every community, from the Missouri River in Omaha to here in Lincoln, to the North Platte River in the Panhandle. We are one Nebraska, and our state can only achieve its full potential if every one of our neighbors has the opportunity to achieve theirs, whether they live across the street or across the state. And that's been my life's work, helping 10,000 small businesses at the Center for Rural Affairs and making college affordable to working students at the University of Nebraska on the Board of Regents.
And now we have the opening statement from Pete Ricketts.
Well, thank you very much, Dennis, for moderating tonight and to the members of the media for asking the questions. I'd also like to thank my lovely wife, Suzanne, and family, without whose love and support none of this would be possible. My family's from Nebraska City. My mom's dad was a farmer. My dad's dad was a carpenter. My mom was a public school teacher. And my dad started a small Nebraska business when I was 13 years old. In high school, there was about a dozen people there. And when I returned after business school, about 150 people. And I helped grow that small Nebraska business. And today, Ameritrade employs over 2,000 people here in Nebraska. And we were able to do that because we figured out ways to deliver our services in a better way. And we have that same opportunity at state government. And that's what I'll do as your governor. I'll use my real-world business experience to make government work better for the citizens of Nebraska. I put together detailed plans for how we can have property tax relief for all Nebraskans, grow jobs, and improve educational outcomes for all of our kids. That's what I'll do as governor, and I look forward to earning your vote.
All right, thank you. Now that the candidates have made their opening statements, it's time for questions from our panel of journalists. We're going to begin with Fred Knapp of NET News with a question for Mr. Ricketts.
Good evening. Problems with Nebraska's prisons continue to dominate the news. You've both made statements about how you deal with the specific problems, but I'd like to ask you to step back and talk about how your leadership style would help prevent or solve problems, whether in corrections, Health and Human Services, or other state agencies.
Fred, thank you for that question, because you really hit on something that is a bigger picture about the bigger picture issue about this, which is how do we change the culture in state government? You know, as an outsider looking at it, it seems to me in the Department of Corrections, we had a culture where people were afraid to talk to their bosses and give them bad news. And so what we have to do is bring about cultural change, not only in the Department of Corrections, but throughout state government. And that's going to require new leadership. So whether it's the Department of Corrections or HHS, I'll do a national job search to find that talent that will come in and help bring about that change. We need that new leadership. We also need to put in new systems in place to be able to help do the things we do better. For instance, with regard to doing the prison calculations, software might have helped avoid some of this error, maybe an email going out to the people who needed to know about what those prison sentences were. That would be one way that we can help change the system so that we can do a better job at delivering services, which is something we have to do throughout government. We also need to reform the good time law. It should become earned time, and for repeat violent offenders, it should be no earned time or good time at all. And finally, we need to look at how we can address some of the prison overcrowding with things like drug courts, veterans courts, things that people, you know, states all across the country use. You know, drug courts are like 90 to 95% effective. So those are some of the ways that we can address some of these issues within our prison population. In fact, the Council of State Governments was just here a few weeks ago and recommended those very same things. Supervised release and probation officers are another way to help address this. It's about a tenth of as expensive to hire a probation officer as it is to actually incarcerate somebody. All those things will help us really start changing that culture in the Department of Corrections.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Hassebrook.
Well, Nebraskans are rightly concerned about the dysfunction we see today in state government. Our Department of Health and Human Services is failing to protect our most vulnerable Nebraskans. We've been repaying tens of millions of dollars at the expense of Nebraska taxpayers to the federal government because of a failure to follow federal rules. In the Department of Corrections, we've released some of the most dangerous criminals before they finish their sentences, even after their record in prison demonstrates that they're a threat to public safety. We've released them to prey on our families, innocent Nebraskans, and four Omahans are dead as a result. As governor, the buck will stop at my desk. I will take responsibility. I will be an active, engaged, hands-on governor. I'll pay attention, I'll ask tough questions, and I'll hold people accountable. And on day one, I will set in action the steps to change our current good time rules, because under current statute, the governor has the authority to take away every day of automatically granted good time from prisoners who demonstrate by their behavior in prison that they're a threat to public safety. The current governor hasn't done it. I will on day one. And beyond that, we'll take steps for those Nebraskans who can get their lives turned around to work with them through drug courts, mental health courts, and veteran courts, because those are more effective alternatives for folks who just need some help getting their lives on track. But one thing will stop when I'm governor, and that is we are going to stop releasing dangerous criminals to prey on Nebraskans.
Thank you, Mr. Hassebrook. Our next question comes from Susan Reisinger of WJAG Radio, and Mr. Hassebrook will answer first.
The state of Nebraska ended the fiscal year with a cash reserve balance of more than $700 million. How much do you think should be in that rainy day fund, and what would you like to do with the balance?
Well, that cash reserve fund is critical because I served in an elected position for 18 years on the University of Nebraska budget, and I went through three budget downturns. And one of the things I learned is that sound fiscal management includes saving money in the good times so you can get through the tough times when the budgets go south. So we need to keep a healthy financial reserve. I think anything we use that financial reserve for today should not be an ongoing expenditure. We have to keep that in place for the long term, and then there may be some critical one-time expenditures that we need to make. For example, it may be necessary for us to make investments in additional prison space, particularly treatment space, for prisoners with drug addictions, for prisoners with mental health problems. And we need to have funds in place to make those kinds of critical one-time investments. So I'm not going to draw down that rainy day fund on ongoing expenditures that we're not going to be able to sustain, because sound, conservative fiscal management requires that in the good times, like we have now, you don't just blow it all to live for today. You save it for the long term so you can sustain state government, sustain critical investments in our future through the tough times.
Mr. Ricketts? Yeah, this is one of the things where I would like to work with the unicameral to come up with what that right number is. I do think that it's overfunded right now. And in fact, I would think somewhere less than $700 million, maybe closer to $500 million might be more appropriate. But I want to work as a partner with the unicameral to establish that. And the way I want to return that is back to the taxpayers. They're the ones that paid the bills in the first place. And I think this is where you're going to see kind of contrast between myself and my opponent. I believe those taxpayer dollars should be returned to the taxpayers when it's possible. And in fact, I've put together a property tax relief plan that calls for putting more money into the property tax relief plan specifically to give that sales and income tax relief back to the citizens of Nebraska that will benefit all property owners. And so that is one of the opportunities that we would have to be able to return those tax dollars back to the citizens of Nebraska, to be able to return that to them to get property tax relief. Because as I've traveled around the state, that is absolutely the number one issue people talk to me about is property taxes. Whether you're talking to a farmer or a rancher or in Omaha, it's about property tax relief. And so that'll be my number one priority to work with the unicameral to establish that.
Adrian Whitsett of KETV has our next question directed first toward Mr. Ricketts.
Use of tax increment financing for economic development projects has reportedly gone up exponentially since the mid-90s now to today. There's currently an interim study in the legislature to look at the use of TIF and how it may impact property tax revenue for local governments. Do you support TIF to spur economic development, and how would you might change its use?
TIF is a tool, you know, the tax increment financing, that can be used effectively or not. And I've talked to folks who've had it used effectively. I've also talked to folks who have said it's been misused. So I think one of the things we can do at the state is maybe put forward some guidelines so local communities maybe have a template for how to establish that but-for clause, because that's really what the key is. If the project wouldn't happen but for the TIF financing, then it's probably a pretty good use. If it's helping to redevelop, especially in low economic neighborhoods, to help get some of that redevelopment, to maybe clear out a building, establish some sewers if that's necessary, or streets, those are all good uses for how we use TIF. And I think the issue is just coming up with how do we set those standards for what the but-for clause is, when the but-for clause is met, because that will help us have more effective use of TIF. But absolutely, it's a tool that we can have to help us redevelop our neighborhoods, help us create economic activity, and it's certainly one of the things that we should have in our toolbox for our communities so that they can do that.
Mr. Hassebrook?
Well, TIF is a tool that we've used in my community of Lyons, so I agree that it's a valuable tool. I think sometimes it's appropriately used and sometimes it's not so appropriately used. It's important. I mean, the purpose of TIF was to help develop those areas that would not have otherwise been developed, areas that were kind of falling behind in prosperity. I think its use in recent years has grown far beyond that, and so we need to go back and reexamine those guidelines and make sure we're using TIF to help develop the areas that need to be developed. One other thing I would say about TIF is we have a history in state government in recent years of passing laws to commit local funds to various projects without bringing everyone at the table. And the one thing I would say is that when TIF property tax breaks are extended, we need to bring all the local governments that are affected to the table so they can have a say in the decision.
Well, you're watching and listening to Nebraska's gubernatorial debate presented by NET News in cooperation with the Nebraska Broadcasters Association. A reminder, we're live tweeting this debate, so join in the conversation on Twitter at the hashtag NETDebate. We continue now with our questions for candidates Pete Ricketts and Chuck Hassebrook. And Fred Knapp of NET News is up next with a question that will be directed first toward Mr. Hassebrook.
Today, 22% of Nebraska families with children are headed by a single mother, 9% by a single father, and less than 70% by married couples. That's a dramatic change from where those numbers were 3 decades ago. Should Nebraska make any changes to respond to this trend, and should we consider changing the law to favor shared parenting in custody cases?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure about that. I mean, I think it's an issue I need to study more. I do think that there have been many negative impacts of the breakdown in family and the loss in the growing number of children being raised in one family. One of the challenges we face today is that we have a lot of children in Nebraska who aren't getting what they need at home because parents are so stressed. Many single families are living in poverty. They're stressed for time because they're trying to hold jobs. And many of those children don't get what they need at home to prepare them to succeed in kindergarten. And I would say we all have a stake in fixing that, because if those kids don't succeed in school, they're not going to contribute to the state's prosperity. They're going to come back to cost us in special education, in public assistance, and in prisons. So I think one of the most important things we can do is expand early childhood education and improve the quality of our child care. So those young children that are being raised in single families, in low-income families, and are dependent on child care settings that are pretty low-cost child care settings or lower-cost child care settings can get the quality of care they need to learn and to develop intellectually and as people so that when they get to be adults, they can be successful and contribute to our state's prosperity. We all have a stake in making that happen.
And Mr. Ricketts? I've worked with some of the inner-city Catholic schools, and so I've seen firsthand some of the challenges that our kids in our low-income neighborhoods have. You know, oftentimes when a child comes to school, kindergarten, they haven't been read to, so they start behind that way. Sometimes there are nutritional needs. Sometimes there's counseling needs. And I've seen the struggles of single parents who are oftentimes really challenged to be able to help provide that schooling and do everything else they need to do, like their job and everything else in life. So it is a huge question that we face, because it's one of the fundamental things that I think is driving a lot of the troubles that we might have in providing a kid a good education. You know, if a single parent's working, do they have time to spend the time with the child to do homework? I know that at my house, primarily my wife, spent hours and hours with our kids until they started hitting classes that were, you know, above our grade level. But, you know, with our kids, trying to help them through a homework. And it was really a challenge trying to make sure they got that attention. What's the role for the state, you ask? Well, that's a great question. To me, it seems like not every question is going to have a big government answer. This is where we really need to rely on our civic organizations. And that's why it's so important that we have strong civic organizations in our communities to be able to help work with parents, to be able to help give them the additional resources they may need. Now, certainly we can do that through the Health and Human Services, but at the end of the day, one of the things, you know, the people who need our help is they're going to need our love. And a bureaucracy can't love. That's got to be done by people in the community. So as governor, I would try to foster those civic organizations, try and encourage them to get involved, because that's how I've seen it being done really effectively.
Thank you, Mr. Ricketts. Susan Reisinger with the next question directed to Mr. Ricketts.
As Nebraska has closed mental health facilities in favor of more community care, some law enforcement officials have claimed that their jails and prisons have become dumping grounds for those with mental illness. Do you think that Nebraska spends enough money on mental health issues?
Well, certainly this is one of the issues I've heard about as I've been traveling around the state talking to law enforcement officials about the issues with regard to people who need mental health care that continuously end up in their county jails. Also having to transport inmates to get mental health care can be something that takes a deputy all day. It doesn't appear on anybody's budget, but it certainly is an expense to the county. And that, of course, additionally puts pressure on taxes. So it's one of the things we have to take a look at. And I think the way we do it, you know, to your question is, do we spend enough on it? I think this is not so much a question of do we spend enough, but how are we spending the dollars? And with regard to state government, that's where I'm going to start the first place all the time, is to take a look at, are we using our dollars effectively? And again, you know, this is where my real-world experience, I think, is going to be so helpful, because this is what we had to do at Ameritrade all the time. We always had to look to see, are we spending our dollars effectively? Are the solutions we're providing the most effective ones? And even if they were at some point in the past, are they still? So we need to go back and work, and this is one of the reasons why reform in HHS is going to be so important. We need to bring in that transformational leader, and this is why I'll do a nationwide job search to find that person who can come in and help figure out how do we have that reform? How do we start changing that culture in state government to one of continuous improvement, you know, one that any successful business has, so that we're always looking to see how we do things better. And mental health care, obviously, with some of the things we've seen in the past, is a big concern. I've talked to a lot of folks out there who are willing to pitch in from the private sector, so I look forward to working with them as well. Some of them have offered to help with additional resources in looking at this problem. I plan to include a lot of people as we address this problem.
And Mr. Hassebrook.
Well, we're not spending the money the right way. And we have a troubling history in the last decade in Nebraska of cutting in those long-term investments that prevent problems. And then we have to spend more down the road in dealing with the symptoms of those problems. So about a dozen years ago, we cut mental health reimbursements through Medicaid and other programs. And lo and behold, there are very few mental health providers in Nebraska because they lose money every time they provide mental health care to a person. And so we have no mental health care in many parts of rural Nebraska and insufficient mental health care in our metropolitan areas. And is it any wonder that when families with children that have emotional problems and behavioral problems can't get mental health services, is it any wonder that we ended up as the state with the second highest percentage of our children in foster care and one of the highest percentages of our children in prison? Now, those are expensive. And for every dollar we saved by cutting mental health services a decade ago or 12 years ago, we're paying $10 down the road in dealing with the symptoms of failing to address problems up front. And that is a continuing problem in our state, where politicians took the easy path to make easy cuts in long-term investments, and it's coming back to cost us in the long term. And we need leadership that makes investments in the future of this state that pay off in the long term, rather than going for the quick tax break and the quick tax cut and the quick cut.
Thank you, Mr. Hassebrook. And our next question from Adrian Whitsett of KETV, directed to Mr. Hassebrook.
And Nebraska has recently started recruiting veterans from other states to come work here in our state. What would you do to retain Nebraska's veterans, and what more do you think the state can do to ensure their transition back into civilian life is a smooth one?
Well, I think there's a number of things we need to do better for our veterans. This year, the legislature passed some tax provisions to soften the tax burdens on veterans who've retired from the military. But I find some other things that have happened in state government profoundly troubling in regards to how they treat our veterans. And again, it's quick buck savings at the expense of people who've sacrificed their lives, or at least risked their lives and sacrificed their emotional health. For example, I stopped at Goodwill Industries in Grand Island recently, and I learned that they provide employment support services to people with mental illness, and they can provide those services and be funded through Medicaid to provide them to people with schizophrenia or bipolar disease or what have you. But our state unilaterally decided, or arbitrarily decided, that post-traumatic stress syndrome is not a mental illness for purposes of providing employment support services. And that is just wrong. It's just wrong economically, it's wrong budgetarily, because when we enable, first of all, we owe better to our veterans. But when we make it possible for them to hold jobs, it's good for all of us. It saves money for all of us, it makes our state stronger, and it makes our economy stronger. So when I'm governor, I'm not going to make shortcuts like that at the expense of our veterans who sacrificed and who've risked their lives and their emotional health.
Mr. Ricketts.
At Ameritrade, when I was the chief operating officer, we benefited tremendously from veterans who retired and came to work for us. In fact, when I was there, the gentleman who was running my new accounts department was a retired Air Force lieutenant colonel. The gentleman who was running my training department was a retired Air Force colonel. And the gentleman who was running my back office operations was a former Marine major. And in fact, that last gentleman is still there running all the operations. All those folks started actually at an entry level and quickly worked their way up into management because of the skills and experience and training they received in the military. And so we want to make sure we retain those folks. And right now, frankly, we're asking them to leave our state. I met with a veterans group just a few weeks ago, and they were telling me about some of the issues that they face when they're trying to live here in Nebraska. The taxes are one of them. We're one of a handful of states that actually taxes military retirement benefits. We made a step last session, but frankly, I had a veteran tell me it was a slap in the face to him because he had already retired and the tax package we passed only covered future retiring veterans. That's one of the things that we have to address going forward in our future, because these are folks who have sacrificed so much for our country. We need to take care of them. And, you know, as I was talking to the veterans, they're really kind of a humble group. They're not asking for a lot. A lot of them just want to know that they're appreciated. You know, one of the veterans told me, you know, down in Florida, they put something on my license plate. They give me discounts on hunting permits, you know, things like that. that could be so easy for us to do at the state to show our appreciation. It's one of the things that we have to do here in Nebraska to create an environment that is more friendly to veterans. And certainly, again, in Ameritrade, we greatly benefited from that. This is the Nebraska gubernatorial debate presented by NET News in cooperation with the Nebraska Broadcasters Association. I'm NET News Director Dennis Kellogg, your moderator. Joining me are journalists Fred Knapp of NET News, Susan Reisinger of WJAG Radio in Norfolk, and Adrian Whitsett of KETV in Omaha. We're talking with the candidates for governor, Democrat Chuck Hassebrook and Republican Pete Ricketts. The next two questions will come from the candidates. They will ask each other a question, and a coin toss determined the first question will come from Pete Ricketts. Chuck, you co-authored a paper with some extremist environmental groups entitled Biotechnology Bitter Harvest. And in that paper, you were against innovation in agriculture. You advocated for the United Nations to put restrictions on our farm exports and against other countries actually importing our farm exports. Given that agriculture is our largest industry and your policies would have cost Nebraska farmers over $17 billion and untold billions of costs and lost productivity, how do you explain that to Nebraska farmers?
Well, Peter, actually, I never advocated restrictions on export of genetically engineered crops. In fact, I was shocked and never approved having my name put on that report. I'd written a few paragraphs to provide some input on the impact on farming practices and, frankly, on family farming. And unbeknownst to me, the report came out with my name on it and a recommendation that I had never supported. But let's set the record straight. Look at my whole record on biotechnology and on agricultural research and on all agricultural policy. I have a very strong record of advocating for biotechnological research that strengthens our family farms and ranches, that worked for them to help them reduce cost and become more competitive and improve their incomes. And I was very strong on this. And we had an issue at the University of Nebraska when I was on the Board of Regents, where biotechnology developed at the University of Nebraska, and I supported development of the technology. It improved weed control for farmers. But the university, without approval of the board, or it didn't need the approval of the board, though, sold the exclusive right for that patent to Monsanto Corporation, which already had a monopoly on the most important gene for herbicide tolerance in crops and for to use in weed control. And by granting an exclusive license to that new technology, to the same company that already had a monopoly, it helped a large out-of-state corporation siphon money out of farmers' bank accounts and out of rural Nebraska. So I've been a strong fighter for biotechnological research, but biotechnological research that supports our family farms and ranches, not helps large out-of-state corporations take money from them.
And now it's time for Mr. Hassebrook to ask Mr. Ricketts a question.
Pete, while you were leading the Platt Institute, it testified for a tax plan that cut taxes on CEOs and financial corporations like yours, while raising them on 8 in 10 Nebraskans by taxing prescription drugs, hospital rooms, students' dormitory rooms, and farmer seed, fertilizer, chemicals, and equipment. Then almost a year later, when you were running for governor, you tried to cover it up. How can middle-class Nebraskans trust you to work for them when you have a track record of working against them?
Well, as Chuck knows, what he just said is not true, and he knows it's not true. We actually covered this in the last debate. The Platt Institute is an organization, it's a nonprofit, that writes papers, academic papers. And it actually is something as a fiscally conservative free market. And I'm very interested in their ideas because it's about trying to develop ideas that will reduce taxes and spending here in the state. And that's a good thing. Now, I didn't agree with every tenet of every paper that came out. And certainly what Chuck is referring to is LB 405 and 406, which I've come out strongly against because that bill had some critical flaws. It taxed the inputs of farmers and ranchers, and that would have been devastating to our two biggest industries. And so I've been very much against that. And one of the things that a lot of people may not know about me is that I had a very middle-class upbringing. You know, when the success that occurred at Ameritrade and the growth really happened after I joined the firm many years later. And so growing up, you know, when the oven door broke, we had to prop a chair against it because that's what you did till you had the money to pay. The dishwashers in the house were me and my siblings. You know, I used the earnings from my first paper route to be able to buy a 10-speed Huffy bicycle. So those are the things that I think that most middle-class Nebraska families go through. They understand that they've got a budget and they've got to live on that budget. And that's the way I was raised. And that's the way I'll treat your tax dollars when I'm governor. What I'll do is make sure that we treat those tax dollars like they belong to you, because they do. We need to spend them very, very carefully. And I'll be a good steward of your tax dollars. Back now to our questions from our panel of Nebraska journalists. Up next is Fred Knapp of NET News with a question for Mr. Ricketts.
We received a lot of input from the public suggesting questions about marijuana. Colorado's legalization has resulted in uneven enforcement of the laws in western Nebraska, with some counties sharply increasing spending on enforcement while others are much less strict. Should the state devote more resources to enforcement, and what role should changing public opinion on this subject play in determining Nebraska's laws in the future?
Well, certainly, as I've talked to law enforcement officials in the western part of our state, I've heard the exact same thing, Fred, you just described with regard to the problems it's creating on our border with Colorado. Sheriff Jensen was saying he had 4 murders in Sydney, and they don't really have that. One of them was over $150 worth of marijuana. So the change in Colorado's law is absolutely impacting us here. And as governor, I'll work with those county sheriffs and the state patrol to make sure that we figure out how we can coordinate better with this Colorado State Patrol, what additional resources may be necessary, and how we get those resources. But it actually points up a great thing on what a bad idea legalizing marijuana is. It's one of the things that ought not to have happened in Colorado. Obviously, they're free to do what they want. But we here in the state have to look at our alternatives as well about how we deal with it. They're impacting us here. And as governor, I'll be a strong advocate for our folks here in the state pushing back on Colorado and the things they've done that are hurting Nebraskans. And so we've got a variety of different things we can pursue with regard to perhaps legal cases. Certainly working better with Colorado State Patrol is another opportunity for us. But this is one of the things that is going to be a real problem for years to come until Colorado undoes their marijuana law. And certainly when it comes to that here in the state, I will oppose any attempt to do that. It's a dangerous drug that ought to be tested by the FDA before anybody's allowed to use it, and that has not happened. And so I will absolutely resist any attempt to do that here in Nebraska.
Mr. Hassebrook.
Well, I oppose following Colorado in legalizing marijuana, and I oppose it in part because the scientific evidence is pretty strong that marijuana use, particularly by adolescents, leads to detrimental effects on their intellectual development, on their cognitive development, and you know, I think we need to oppose that. I'm against the legalization of marijuana. With respect to the Colorado border, I think we need to look at how we handle cases of people possessing marijuana coming across the border. It's put an extreme burden on some of our local police departments, and maybe what we need to look at is changing the penalty structure so we put heavier fines on folks bringing marijuana into our state to help cover those law enforcement costs. I think that's one way we can start dealing with the burdens that's putting on our local law enforcement groups. But I do want to say one thing about Pete's last answer about, you know, when the Platt Institute goes in and testifies for a bill, that they're just putting ideas out there. Well, I have to tell you, I have a transcript from that hearing, and when they ask for the first proponent of the legislation, you know who came up first? The Platt Institute. And in fact, according to an article in the Lincoln Journal Star, instead of being actual honest think tanks, the Platt Institute and affiliated groups in other states work for billionaire funders and push an extreme agenda that most benefits those at the very top level of income. That's not a think tank. That's an advocacy group who's working against the interest of the middle class.
I want to take just a moment to shift a little bit, as part of Fred's question had to do with changing public opinion on the subject of marijuana, and what should that play in lawmaking? Should we be paying attention to what the public wants when it comes to marijuana laws? I don't think either of you really addressed that, so 30 seconds each, beginning with Mr. Ricketts for that part of the question.
Well, as I said, as governor, I will be an advocate against legalizing marijuana here, and I think the governor has the office to be able to do that. And with regard to the Platt Institute, it's a Nebraska-based firm that advocates for reducing taxes here on Nebraskans and offering free market ideas on how to do that. As I said, I don't agree with all the tenants in it, but it's meant to start a discussion. My opponent, on the other hand, works for a true activist organization and has advocated actually against the farming policies that would have helped grow Nebraska. And so I think there's a very different contrast here in these two different organizations.
Mr. Hassebrook, I'll go back to you on the topic of marijuana.
Well, we must always consider public opinion and public policy. But as leaders, we also have to have a moral core. Where we, you know, there are certain principles that we believe in and that we will stand for even when they're unpopular, and I will do that. And as far as my record, you know, the Nebraska Farmers Union and presidents or board chairs of the commodity organizations and boards for every one of the five major Nebraska commodities, beef, pork, corn, soybeans, and wheat, have endorsed me in this race. Surely can't be anti-agriculture.
All right, we're going to move on. Susan Reisinger of WJAG Radio has a question directed first towards Mr. Hassebrook.
North Omaha has the nation's highest child poverty rate for any U.S. black metropolitan area. Fremont is enforcing a housing ordinance aimed at immigrants who come into this country illegally. Nebraska is the only state to deny driver's licenses to the children of such immigrants, and in Norfolk, a 4th of July parade resulted in claims of racism. Do you see Nebraska as a diversity-friendly state? Why or why not?
Well, I think we're a diversity-friendly state in many respects, but we have some challenges that we need to address. I mean, I find it troubling that of the 50 states, 49 of those states, but not Nebraska, provide driver's licenses to young people who were brought here as infants or children by their parents as undocumented immigrants. Now, I deeply respect American law. And a fundamental principle of American law is that we hold people culpable and accountable only for actions over which they have influence or control. And to punish these young people by denying them a driver's license violates the fundamental core principle of American law. And it's also not in the best interest of every Nebraskan because, you know, we spend the money to educate these young people, to get them through high school. And then we say that if you want to get a job and drive to work and give something back, you have to move to Iowa or Kansas or South Dakota. What sense does that make? So we do have some problems in this state that we need to address. I don't think Nebraskans are anti-diversity, but I think we've had a problem in leadership in this state where we haven't had the leaders to step up and provide leadership to stand for fairness and justice for every Nebraskan. And in North Omaha, the most important thing we can do there is to create good jobs and to help every child growing up in North Omaha have the chance to start kindergarten prepared to succeed. That's not happening now. That's why we need to expand our investment in early childhood education.
And Mr. Ricketts.
The Nebraskans I know are diversity friendly. Now, does that mean we can't always be improving? Absolutely. We always will be trying to improve on this issue. The issue with regard to North Omaha that you mentioned, again, education is the great equalizer there. We can get a child a great education. That's the pathway to success. That's the way, that greatest gift that we can give them to help them have the future they deserve. And that's why I've worked with the inner-city Catholic schools to help do that. And that's where you see a lot of this outreach, to be able to help, where we can help people get that education, because that's so important. We're also a welcoming nation from immigration standpoint. I mean, we're all immigrants in one way or another. But we're also a nation of laws. And that's where you're going to see a big difference between myself and my opponent. My opponent believes in giving taxpayer benefits to illegal immigrants. I don't believe it's fair or right. It's certainly not fair to the taxpayers who are paying those taxes that expect them to go to people who are here legally. And it's not fair to the people who are trying to go through the process legally to come to this country. I was talking to a gentleman, and his son-in-law was from Guatemala, and they're trying to get him to be a U.S. citizen. It's a long process and expensive. And he was saying, you know, why is it fair to allow somebody to jump and cut in line when I'm trying to do it the right way and feel like I'm being penalized? So that's what we face here with regard to this immigration issue. And our president, through his unilateral action, has created a catastrophe at the human border with all these unaccompanied minors coming to our country. We at the state ought not to be a part of that catastrophe, contributing to it by giving taxpayer benefits to illegal immigrants. And as I said, this is a big difference between myself and my opponent.
Up next, a question from Adrian Witset of KETV, directed to Mr. Ricketts.
One of the challenges facing Nebraska is growing a skilled workforce. This year, Tennessee began providing 2 years of post-secondary education at community colleges at no cost to state residents. Would you support either a free community college education for Nebraskans or at least more state support for community colleges in exchange for lower tuition? If so, where does the money come from? If not, what other ideas do you have for growing a skilled workforce?
Right. You know, one of the things I've talked about a lot on the campaign is improving educational outcomes through career and vocational training. It's really one of the pillars of my platform. And the reason that's so is for a couple. One, that I haven't talked to a single manufacturer yet who hasn't told me they can't find enough welders or machinists or electricians. And two, we have a lot of great career opportunities that are out there available. I was talking to Ash Grove Cement, and they were telling me that if you go get a 2-year electrician's degree out of high school, come work for them, you'll start at $22 or $23 an hour. Stay there a year and pass 2 tests, you'll be making $28 an hour. And think about that. That's a 21-year-old making $56,000 a year plus full benefits. That's the start of a great career. So we absolutely need to do more with regard to career and vocational training. I actually think it starts younger. In junior high, you know, when I was in junior high, everybody was required to take industrial arts. But that's not true in my school district anymore. And then there's also things like the Career Pathways Institute. See, Grand Island's a great example of a public-private partnership where the Grand Island public school system partnered with the private sector and Central Community College providing teachers. And what I like about that program, it's Plan A, because for too long in our education system, we've said, you can only be successful by getting that 4-year degree, and it's not true. It should be Plan A, go get that 4-year degree, or Plan A, go to into the skilled labor force. How do we address it? Well, I actually like systems that Michigan has put in place, the Michigan Advanced Technical Training Program. They've partnered with the private sector. The businesses are actually the ones who are paying to change, that are paying for the education. They're coming in, working with the high schools to change the curriculum, and then paying for their post-secondary education. That's a way that we can get that training and be friendly to taxpayers.
Mr. Hassebrook.
You know, I spent 18 years on the University of Nebraska Board of Regents, and my wife is a member of our local school board, so we've made a strong commitment to education. And one of the things I've learned, and by the way, in our last budget, when I was on the Board of Regents, we worked out an arrangement whereby with sufficient state funding, we were able to hold our tuition at the same level as it had been for the several years before. But if we want to really make this state grow, the single most important thing we can do is build an education system that is second to none in America, right here in our state. Because there's no greater economic advantage we can have than in the 21st century than a well-educated, well-trained, and highly motivated workforce. And much of that has to start early, with early childhood education programs that enable kids to succeed in school. Because in recent years, when in Omaha there's been efforts to move more low-income students into the community college, they've run into a problem in that they haven't been successful enough in school to compete in community college. So we both have to improve early childhood education so kids have a chance to succeed in school, and then we need to improve our technical education. Now, as far as community colleges, I would make the state a partner with our community colleges and schools in offering our juniors in high school the opportunity to spend half of their day taking community college courses in technical fields. We have some good programs doing that, but the state hasn't really helped. The leadership has to come from the local level, but the state can help by providing tuition assistance and other costs to help make that happen.
Thank you, Mr. Hassebrook. Well, you are watching and listening to the Nebraska Gubernatorial Debate presented by NET News in cooperation with the Nebraska Broadcasters Association. A reminder that you can follow the debate on Twitter at the hashtag NETDebate. Well, our next question comes from Fred Knapp of NET News, and Mr. Hassebrook will answer first.
The state has now confirmed that an average of 3 trains a week carrying Bakken crude oil are traveling from South Sioux City through Fremont and Lincoln to Rulo by rail. Does this raise safety concerns for you, and does it affect your thinking on the Keystone XL pipeline, which could carry some Bakken crude oil?
Yeah, well, you know, last week, the University of Nebraska came out with a study. The university was charged to look at climate change, the extent of climate change, its causes, and its implications for the state of Nebraska. And they released their report last week, and they said that the scientific debate about climate change and the extent to which burning fossil fuels is contributing, the scientific debate is over. Because the scientific research is overwhelming that the use of fossil fuels is contributing to climate change. And we know that burning oil and developing oil in the tar sands region of Canada contributes far more to climate change than our own domestic crude oil sources. So That's one of the reasons I've opposed developing the Keystone Pipeline, because I believe we have a responsibility, a moral responsibility, to our children and grandchildren to step up and address this issue and not just live for today and pass the buck and the cost on to our children and grandchildren. So I think it would be good to build some pipelines to move oil from the Bakken Range to get that oil into Nebraska markets because, Nebraska, and particularly in the case of natural gas, because today in North Dakota and on the Bakken Range, they're flaring off 30% of the natural gas. And that's a great resource we could use for electric generation here that contributes much less to environmental problems like climate change than coal. And so we need to build the right kind of pipelines for Nebraska.
Mr. Ricketts. This is one of those clear distinctions between myself and my opponent. He's against the pipeline. I'm for it. I'm for it because it's going to be good for Nebraska. You touched upon one of the points there with regard to safety. We have three trains, each carrying 1 million gallons of oil going through our state, through 11 counties, every week. And we saw what happened in Canada a year ago when some oil cars rolled down into a little Canadian city and blew up. So there is a safety issue here. And frankly, if you look at what's happened, this oil is moving by rail right now. And we spilled more oil last year moving it by rail than the previous 37 years combined because so much more oil is being moved. And the Keystone Pipeline will carry maybe up to 25% of its volume be Bakken oil coming from the North Dakota. And so from that standpoint, we want to build it. We also want to build it from the standpoint it's going to create about 3,000 jobs while it's being built and about 300 jobs thereafter. It's going to be good for local counties who will see an increase in their property taxes where it goes through. I was talking to a gentleman in Wheeler, or in Erickson, who was unhappy that the route got moved because it's no longer going to be in Wheeler County, and he projects they're going to lose out on about $15 million in property taxes. It's also one of the things that will contribute to energy security here in this country. And finally, I used to work at Union Pacific Railroad. We always had a hard time getting grain cars at harvest time, and it's gotten even harder because crews and the locomotives are being diverted to move the oil. So we want this pipeline built to make sure we can get our products to market, whether it's going to be manufactured goods or agricultural products. We've got to be able to sell them to be able to grow our economy. So for all those reasons, I think we need to build the Keystone Pipeline.
Our next question comes from Susan Reisinger and directed first to Mr. Ricketts.
Nebraska now dedicates a portion of sales tax revenue for road construction. Would you support a similar dedication of tax revenue to fully fund state aid to K-12 schools?
Well, I think that this, when you're talking about education, it's an important thing that we do here at the state, and it's something we need to budget for. And one of the things I absolutely think we need to do to have property tax relief long term is look at the school aid formula. However, I'm not going to be in favor in dedicating part of the sales tax to education that way. I think this is something that we need to work out through the unicameral in a give and take sort of way, because this is something that impacts a lot of different constituencies. The school aid formula is very, very complex. I think my running mate has said that if you wrote it all out, it'd be 100 pages long. So we need to make it more transparent, simpler to understand. And of course, one of the things that it never anticipated was ag land valuations going up this much, this quickly. And that's one of the reasons we've seen so many of our school districts in rural Nebraska lose equalization money. So we absolutely need to have reform of the school aid formula, but I don't believe that dedicating part of the sales tax is the answer for that. I think that education is something we should budget for. We should work with unicameral to come up with that, involve all the different constituencies. Just like you would in any business, you try to bring together all the experts to try and hammer out what that consensus would be. And something that, again, we can buy into all across the state, whether you're in an urban school district or a rural school district. But all that together needs to be factored into that. So that's the approach that I'll use when it comes to funding education here in the state.
Mr. Hassebrook.
Well, I think in funding education, one of the things we need to do is start by fulfilling some of our obligations that we're not fulfilling right now and pushing costs down onto our school districts and local governments and property taxpayers. For example, we need to do a better job at the state level of funding the special education requirements that the state has adopted, and I think rightly so. But we need to do a better job of funding those for schools first. And that would be good for our students, but it would also help provide property tax relief because the state has a history of saying they're cutting spending, but really just shifting spending, pushing costs like special education, like housing state prisoners and not paying the counties for it, and other things down onto local government and onto the property tax. And then the state will say, or the governor will say, well, look, we've cut spending, you cut spending too, when in fact the state really just shifted costs down onto the counties and made them pick up more of the burden and push it on the property taxes. So my first priorities for education will be in things like funding special education, but then beefing up our funding of early childhood education, because we all have a stake in enabling every child in this state the opportunity to start kindergarten prepared to succeed, because it is one of the best long-term investments we can make, because every dollar that we spend that enables a young child to start kindergarten prepared to succeed in school will save us $10 down the road in costs for special education, for prisons, and public assistance.
Well, we're nearing the end of the debate. We have time just for one more question from our panel, and we're going to ask the candidates to respond in 60 seconds instead of 90 seconds. So we call this the lightning round, I guess. We begin with Adrian Whitsett with our final question, directed first to Mr. Hassebrook.
60 seconds. A report from the Environment America Research and Policy Center said Nebraska's rivers and streams are among the worst in the country for toxic pollution, most of those from nitrates. What focus would you have as governor on cleaning up such an important resource?
Well, my history at the Center for Rural Affairs, we did a lot of work to support voluntary conservation programs that work with farmers to help them improve their environmental performance. But I think this is a serious issue, and we need to put real resources on research on farming practices that help farmers be the best environmental stewards possible while farming profitably. And that's much of the work I did at the Center for Rural Affairs. So we need to put a high priority on that. We also need to pay attention to the sustainability of our water use, because the demands on water use are only going to grow greater. And we have a good policy in this state. We have a good policy framework in this state that says that we're going to use water at a sustainable rate. In other words, we're going to use it at a rate that keeps it there for our children and grandchildren. And we have an obligation to do that. The key is that we need to stick by our guns and stand by that policy and make it work. And the good thing we do at the state level is we have enforcement of that through natural resource districts to make it responsive and accountable to local people.
Mr. Ricketts, 60 seconds.
Yeah, water availability and quality are big issues here in the Nebraska because, of course, we're the biggest irrigated state in the country. And I put out a plan for growing agriculture here in Nebraska that touches upon water. Because, well, it actually has got a big part of it because we have to make sure we use our water in a wise way, and it's got to be sustainable. And so as I've been making my way around the state, I talk to different NRDs, and what I'll do as governor is pull together all the different diverse groups we have in the state, groundwater users, surface water users, recreational users, municipalities, public power, to craft that overall water strategy of the state. We do have a water policy here in the state that is the envy of the rest of the country because we have local control. So that means really only the governor can pull all those things together and address the issues like water quality. That agriculture plan that I mentioned is one of the reasons why I've got the endorsement of the Nebraska Farm Bureau and the support of the Nebraskan Cattlemen's Pact, because I've worked with agriculture to craft those plans, and that's what I'll do as governor, continue to work with all the interests across the state to be able to come up with that water plan, that water strategy, that will help make sure that we continue to be the number one irrigated state.
So as we near the end of our time tonight, each candidate will now have 90 seconds for their closing statements, and we begin with Chuck Hassebrook.
The choice in this election comes down to who you trust to fight for the middle class and every Nebraskan. I have a track record of doing just that. My life's work has been to get Nebraskans working together, to build a better future in our state for our children and grandchildren, to strengthen our middle class and communities, and create good jobs and genuine opportunity for every Nebraskan. For 36 years at the Center for Rural Affairs, I fought to strengthen our family farms and ranches. I helped 10,000 small businesses get started, and I worked with rural communities across this state to help themselves revitalize and build a better future. For 18 years on the University of Nebraska Board of Regents, I fought to keep education affordable by providing a hand up to those students from working families who'd prepared for college but just couldn't afford the tuition. And I worked to get our university more involved in building the economy in both our rural and metropolitan areas. You know, I believe Nebraska is one of America's best-kept secrets. We have a great quality of life, and we have that quality of life in part because our ancestors were willing to make forward-looking decisions and willing to make investments at some sacrifice to themselves so that our children, so that their children and grandchildren and their neighbors' children and grandchildren could have a better future. And I think we owe it to them to do the same. That's why I'm running for governor. That's why I ask for your support. God bless our great state, and God bless all of you.
And now the closing statement from Pete Ricketts. What we've seen here tonight is two competing visions for how to take the state forward. On the one hand, Chuck wants to grow government, whether it's Obama-style policies like expanding Obamacare here in the state, giving taxpayer benefits to illegal immigrants, or even co-authoring a paper that advocated for restricting Nebraska farm exports. I, on the other hand, have put out a plan for growing Nebraska with Nebraska-based solutions. I put out detailed plans how we can have property tax relief for all Nebraskans, how we can grow jobs, especially in agriculture and manufacturing, and how we can create better educational opportunities for all of our kids, especially in career and vocational training. And we have to remember, we have a great foundation here. We have the second lowest unemployment rate in the state or in the country. We're the number one state for cattle on feed, number two for ethanol production, number three for corn. We just got an award for the most economic development starts per capita. Now what we have to do is build on that foundation. And that's what I'll do as your governor. I'll use my real-world experience to work with people all across the state and the senators in our unicameral to craft that plan for how we grow Nebraska, how we create more and better-paying jobs, how we keep more of our kids and grandkids here, how we provide the futures that our Nebraska families so want and deserve. Because at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. So I ask for your vote. Thanks for watching tonight. Have a great evening, and God bless.
That brings us to the conclusion of tonight's gubernatorial debate. Thank you to the candidates, to Pete Ricketts and to Chuck Hassebrook. Thank you to our panel of journalists, Fred Knapp, Susan Reisinger, and Adrian Whitsett. Thanks also to the Nebraska Broadcasters Association for partnering with NET News. And thank you to our audience and all of you who are watching or listening at home. This debate will be archived and available on the NET website at netnebraska.org/campaignconnection2014. And the conversation continues on our Facebook page at NET News Nebraska. Leave a comment on how you felt the candidates did this evening. I'm Dennis Kellogg, reminding you to make sure your voice is heard by voting in the upcoming election. Good night, everyone.
You've been listening to a special program on Noon Forum. We've heard the third in a series of three debates presenting candidates in the upcoming general election on November 4th. Today's debate has been between the two candidates for governor of Nebraska, Republican Pete Ricketts and Democrat Chuck Hassebrook. According to a recent CBS News New York Times poll, as reported by Omaha Public Radio, Pete Ricketts holds an approximate 20% lead over Chuck Hassebrook. This program, presented by the Nebraska Broadcasters Association and NET Television, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, October 2, 2014, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to James Tim of the Nebraska Broadcasters Association and Dennis Kellogg of NET Television for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 400 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.